Imagine looking at a spreadsheet where wholesale inflation is just surging.
Yeah, totally surging.
And the 30-year treasury yield just crossed the threshold we literally haven't seen since 2007. Plus, mortgage rates are punishingly high, sitting at like 6.66%.
Which is painful.
Right. So the basic math of underwriting tells you the housing market should be, you know, frozen solid right now.
Exactly. Just completely at a standstill.
But then you look out the window and a million buyers just jumped off the sidelines.
It's wild. It really is.
So welcome to the deep dive, especially to all you real estate operators out there. Today, we are unpacking the ultimate rate paradox of May 2026.
And we have a lot to cover.
We really do. We're pulling from a massive stack of sources today. We've got Redfin's latest April data, macro reports from the National Apartment Association and BitePath, plus capital strategies from SoFi and my solo 401k financial.
Yeah, and we're also digging into some behavioral frameworks and concession data from Mission Wealth, Available Max, and JVM Lending.
Exactly. Our mission today is to figure out how you, the operator, can underwrite and actually close deals when the macro data is just completely contradicting human behavior.
Because that contradiction is like the defining feature of the market right now.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because you have macroeconomic indicators acting as a massive stop sign.
Right, right. But the volume of participants is accelerating anyway. And to make sense of it, you really have to start by looking at the subtle shifts in leverage.
Oh, for sure. The April 2026 Redfin data gives us a really specific snapshot.
It does. Currently, there are 46.5% more sellers than buyers in the U.S. market.
Which, you know, at first glance, screams that buyers hold all the cards. I mean, Redfin classifies anything over a 10% seller surplus as a buyer's market.
Yeah, but here is the crucial piece of context that you have to bake into your underwriting.
Right, the trend.
Exactly. That 46.5% surplus is actually down from a peak of 48.9% back in December 2025.
Wait, really? So the gap is visibly shrinking?
Yes. Buyer leverage is passing its peak right now. New buyers are entering the arena faster than new listings are hitting the MLS.
Wow. Okay, so how many buyers are we talking about here?
Well, Redfin estimates there were around 1 million home buyers actively touring in April. That's a 2% jump from March.
And that's significant, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the largest month-over-month increase in 13 months. Redfin's senior economist, Asad Khan, actually pointed out that this growing buyer pool could finally bring the market out of its deep freeze.
But this brings us right to the core paradox. I mean, how is buyer demand ticking up by 2% at the exact moment capital is getting drastically more expensive?
Right. That's the big question. And to answer that, we have to look under the hood of the macro data from the National Apartment Association and BitePath.
Right. The PPI report.
Yeah. The April Producer Price Index, yeah. Or PPI.
Right.
That tracks wholesale inflation before it reaches the consumer. And it saw a massive surge.
Like how massive?
It jumped 6.0% year over year and 1.4% month over month. We actually haven't seen a monthly spike like that since March 2022.
Wow. And PPI is basically the upstream cost, right?
Yes.
It's the price of goods leaving the factory gate or the refinery.
Exactly. And looking at the breakdown, wholesale gasoline costs specifically skyrocketed 15.6% in a single month.
That is a huge jump. What caused that?
Well, looking strictly at the economic catalysts cited in our sources, and just to be clear, we are impartially reporting the economic triggers here, not taking any political sides. That energy spike was triggered by global supply disruptions.
Ah, okay. Where exactly?
Mostly shipping choke points in the Strait of Hormuz. That geopolitical bottleneck created an immediate, tangible shock to global oil prices.
Right, which bled directly into U.S. wholesale inflation. And the plumbing of how that wholesale gas price eventually hits an operator's monthly mortgage statement is fascinating.
It really is. And it's heavily misunderstood.
Yeah, because it all funnels through the bond market, doesn't it?
It does. When wholesale inflation surges, bond investors realize that the fixed return they're getting on long-term bonds is just going to be eaten alive by that inflation.
So they want more money to compensate for that risk.
Exactly. To compensate for the loss of purchasing power, they demand higher yields. Consequently, the bond market aggressively repriced the risk following that PPI report.
And that caused the 30-year Treasury yield to break above 5% for the first time since 2007.
Yep. And mortgage rates are essentially chained to those Treasury yields. Mortgage-backed securities have to compete with risk-free government treasuries for investor capital.
Right, because if a completely safe 30-year Treasury is paying 5%, a riskier 30-year consumer mortgage has to offer a significant premium to attract any money at all.
Exactly. And that spread is what pushed the average 30-year fixed mortgage up to 6.66%.
Which, frankly, leaves us staring at an economic impossibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a 6.66% mortgage rate and a 6.0% wholesale inflation surge should destroy consumer confidence.
It really should.
But instead, a million buyers are out touring properties. The spreadsheets just cannot explain this.
No, they can't. We have to look at the behavioral economics here. Specifically, the framework provided by Mission Wealth and insights from Redfin's chief economist, Daryl Fairweather.
Oh, right. Doesn't she have a PhD in behavioral economics?
She does. And the takeaway is that human beings do not underwrite their lives like rational calculators.
Yeah, that makes sense. So for buyers, the math of a 6.66% rate is actively being overridden by like two massive psychological forces.
Correct. The first one is present bias. It's the human tendency to heavily overvalue immediate emotional rewards at the expense of long-term financial logic.
Like wanting to get out of a cramped apartment right now.
Exactly. People want the emotional security of leaving a rental today, and they just convince themselves they'll figure out the payment later.
And then you combine that present bias with a severe case of social comparison bias, right? Basically FOMO.
Oh, FOMO is a huge driver here. Buyers watch their peers locking down homes, and they develop a profound fear.
Fear of what? Rates dropping?
Yeah, fear that if they wait for rates to drop back to 4%, institutional capital will flood the market and prices will skyrocket completely out of reach.
Wow, so the fear of being permanently priced out of the middle class is actually a much stronger motivator than the pain of a high monthly interest payment.
Precisely. And, you know, the sell side psychology is just as intense.
Right, because sellers have been completely paralyzed by the endowment effect.
Yes, they attach their ego to their property's peak 2021 Zestimate. And they overvalue the ultra-low 3% mortgage rate they currently hold.
But life events don't care about your interest rate, do they?
Not at all. Divorces, job relocations, growing families, retirements, these things are finally forcing their hands. The status quo bias is basically breaking under the weight of reality.
You know, it's funny. Most aspiring investors are just sitting on the sidelines watching this emotional tug of war, waiting for all the traffic lights to turn green before they deploy capital.
Oh, absolutely. They want low rates, low prices, low inflation, and high demand all at the exact same time.
Which is a total fantasy. Those green lights never align perfectly. The market is, it's like driving in heavy, chaotic traffic. Waiting for an empty road isn't a strategy.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. What makes movement safe in a messy environment is your discipline. It's using your brakes, your turn signals, and your seatbelts.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, for an operator in May 2026, your underwriting discipline is your seatbelt.
Yes. You don't freeze because the data is contradictory.
Yeah.
You use that contradiction to structure better deals.
Exactly. And if you're going to operate in this environment, you have to transition away from retail thinking.
Because the math at 6.66% with traditional bank underwriting is just brutally tight.
It is. This forces operators to execute specific strategic moves, starting with capital diversification. You just cannot rely entirely on traditional banking right now.
So we have to look at alternative capital. Let's start with purchase money mortgages, which the SoFi source outlines.
Right. And a purchase money mortgage is really just the technical term for seller financing.
Basically, you bypass the traditional banking apparatus entirely. The seller holds the promissory note, and you make your monthly payments directly to them.
Yeah, and the mechanical advantage here for an operator is speed and flexibility.
Oh, for sure. You aren't waiting 45 days for a bank underwriter to flag a slightly low debt service coverage ratio or, you know, some minor repair issue.
Exactly. Plus, you can negotiate your own down payment terms. However, the seller is taking on the risk of default.
Right. So the interest rate you negotiate might actually be slightly higher than the 6.66% market rate.
It could be. And the most critical structural feature of seller financing is the timeline. These are almost never 30-year amortizing loans.
Oh, definitely not. They usually involve a short repayment term, maybe 5 to 7 years, ending in a massive balloon payment.
Yep. So as an operator, you are essentially buying yourself a 5-year runway to force appreciation, raise rents, and eventually refinance into a traditional commercial loan.
Or just sell the asset before that balloon detonates.
Exactly. So seller financing is a powerful negotiation tool, but there's another massive pool of capital that operators often overlook.
Oh, the self-directed solo 401k.
Yes. The data from a solo 401k financial highlights this beautifully. If you are a self-employed operator with no full-time W-2 employees, you can direct your retirement funds into alternative assets like real estate.
The tax advantages are incredible. But as an operator, you have to treat a solo 401k like a nuclear reactor.
That is the perfect analogy. It is immensely powerful, but the regulatory shielding requires absolute precision.
Yeah, the IRS rules against self-dealing and prohibited transactions are not just minor compliance hurdles. They are existential threats to your entire portfolio.
Totally. The foundational rule is that you cannot use the retirement funds to create a present-day benefit for yourself or any disqualified person.
And a disqualified person strictly includes your spouse, your parents, grandparents, and your kids, right?
Exactly. The asset must exist entirely for the future benefit of the retirement plan.
Let's make this highly practical for everyone listening. You cannot use the solo 401k to buy a beachfront condo in Miami and then let your kids stay there for a long weekend.
No, absolutely not. That is an immediate disqualification.
Wow. Okay, so it's strict on usage.
Oh, it goes much deeper than just usage. It restricts your operational mechanics, too. Let's say your solo 401k buys a distressed duplex.
Okay, pretty common scenario.
And to boost your margins, you decide to go in on the weekends and do the drywall and plumbing yourself.
I mean, that sounds like a good way to save money.
The IRS calls that sweat equity, and it is completely forbidden.
Wait, really? You can't even do the drywall yourself.
Nope. Because your free labor is considered an untaxed, unreported contribution of value to the retirement plan. It circumvents the annual legal contribution limits.
So what do you have to do?
You must hire a third-party contractor and pay them exclusively using funds from the 401k checking account.
Man, the Capitol borders must be hermetically sealed. I was reading you can't even personally guarantee a loan if your 401k needs extra leverage to close a property.
That's right. The IRS views your personal guarantee as an illegal extension of credit to the plan. You have to secure non-recourse financing.
Meaning the lender's only remedy in a default is seizing the property itself, not coming after your personal assets.
Exactly. And operators also try to get overly creative with the disqualified person rules, which is dangerous.
Give me an example of that.
Well, let's say you want to fund a deal for your father, but he is a disqualified person. An operator might think, I will lend the 401k money to my LLC partner, who is not disqualified, and then my partner will lend those exact funds to my father.
Oh, like a workaround.
Right. But the IRS considers that a roundabout transaction or a straw man deal. You cannot use a third-party conduit to achieve something you are legally prohibited from doing directly.
And what happens if the IRS pierces that veil?
The penalty is catastrophic. The entire account loses its tax-deferred status instantly.
Instantly. Just like that.
Just like that. All the assets are treated as fully distributed on day one, which triggers massive income taxes and early withdrawal penalties. It is a complete portfolio wipeout.
Okay, wow. Which is exactly why capital diversification requires rigorous discipline.
Absolutely.
But once your capital stack is secured, whether that is a solo 401k, a purchase money mortgage, or a traditional commercial loan, you have to deploy that capital into a market where sellers are highly emotional.
And this brings us to the second major operator move, negotiation discipline.
Yes, you really have to know where your leverage actually lives. The Redfin data shows a national average of 46.5% more sellers, but real estate is hyper-localized.
It is. The massive supply gluts are heavily concentrated in the Sun Belt.
Yeah, let's talk about those numbers. Miami currently has 137% more sellers than buyers. Nashville is sitting at 125%. San Antonio is at 112%.
It's crazy. During the peak of the pandemic migration, builders flooded these Sunbelt markets with new housing starts just to meet the frenzied demand.
Right. And now that new construction is finally delivering finished inventory, right as 6.66% rates have sidelined the retail buyers.
Yep. The supply caught up exactly when the demand bottlenecked.
So for an operator, staring at 137% seller surplus demands an abundant mindset.
Mm-hmm.
If you're underwriting a duplex in Nashville and the seller is emotionally anchored to a highly inflated 2022 comp, you do not force the math.
Exactly. You walk away. Mathematically, there is quite literally another motivated seller on the next block.
Right. Finding that motivated seller is step one, but step two is structuring the concession.
And the available max source draws a really brilliant distinction here between the mechanics of a price reduction versus a closing credit.
Because most retail buyers instinctively fight for a price reduction, right? It feels like a victory to get the price down.
It strokes the ego. But let's run the math on a $500,000 duplex in San Antonio.
Okay, let's do it.
If you grind the seller down and secure a $10,000 price reduction, your purchase price is $490,000. Over a 30-year mortgage at 6.66%, that $10,000 reduction saves you roughly $60 a month on your payment.
$60. That's it. And inflation is going to eat the value of those future dollars anyway.
Exactly. A price reduction strokes the buyer's ego, but it barely impacts their daily operational reality.
Conversely, if you keep the purchase price at $500,000, but negotiate a $10,000 closing credit from the seller, you get $10,000 of liquid cash preserved in your bank account on day one.
Which is huge. In an environment where capital is incredibly expensive, preserving your liquid reserves to fund a value-add renovation or cover unexpected vacancies is infinitely more strategic than saving $60 a month.
Oh, absolutely. And it also plays perfectly into the seller's psychology, doesn't it?
It does. Sellers despise price reductions because it damages the public neighborhood comps and, you know, feels like a personal defeat.
Yeah, so by offering a closing credit, the seller gets to boast that they sold the property for the full asking price, while you secure the operational liquidity you actually need.
Win-win. And that same psychological dynamic makes the 2-1 temporary buy-down one of the most effective tools in the current market.
Let's explain that. A 2-1 buy-down is a structure where the seller pays a lump sum at closing into an escrow account, right?
Exactly. And that escrow account is then used to subsidize the buyer's monthly mortgage interest payments for the first 2 years.
So it basically functions as a financial shock absorber.
Very much so.
So using our current 6.66% market rate, if you negotiate a 2-1 buy-down, your effective interest rate for the first 12 months is artificially lowered by exactly 2%. So you're paying an effective rate of 4.66%.
Yep. Then in year two, the subsidy decreases and your rate is 5.66%.
And then by year three, the subsidy is completely exhausted and you return to the permanent 6.66% note rate.
Right. You are absorbing the immediate impact of the high rate pothole. It gives an operator a 24-month runway of significantly lower carrying costs.
Which is plenty of time. You use those 2 years to execute your value add strategy, stabilize the tenant base, raise the rents to market rate, or just wait for broader economic conditions to improve so you can permanently refinance before year three hits.
But operators need to be hyper aware of the regulatory boundaries here. You cannot just ask a desperate seller in Miami to fund a 5-1 buy down and cover 100% of your closing costs.
Yeah, the banking system has strict guardrails on how much a seller is legally allowed to contribute to your side of the ledger.
Yes. The JVM lending source breaks down these limits, which lenders classify as interested party contributions or IPCs.
Okay, IPCs. How do those work?
Well, if you are using conventional financing backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, the absolute ceiling on seller concessions is dictated by your down payment.
Basically, the less skin you have in the game, the tighter the leash.
Precisely. If your down payment is less than 10%, the seller is legally capped at contributing a maximum of 3% of the total purchase price.
Okay, 3%. What if I put down more?
If you put down between 10% and 24.9%, that cap expands to 6%. You only unlock the maximum 9% concession cap if you are putting down 25% or more in cash.
Got it. And what about FHA loans?
For an FHA loan, there is a hard, non-negotiable cap of 6%, regardless of how much you put down.
Here is where the math gets incredibly tight for an operator. A 2-1 buy-down counts directly against that IPC cap.
It sure does.
So if you are buying a property with a 5% down payment, your maximum allowable seller concession is 3%. If the cost of the 2-1 buy-down eats up 2.5% of the purchase price, you only have 0.5% left to ask for in closing credits or repair allowances.
Yep. You have to meticulously allocate every fraction of a percent in your negotiations.
Which honestly circles us right back to the core mission of this analysis. The market is not behaving rationally, but your underwriting must.
Exactly. You're navigating 46.5% more sellers, decades-high treasury yields, and an unexpected surge in buyer demand. These are conflicting realities.
They really are. But conflict creates the inefficiencies where sophisticated operators thrive. The contradiction isn't a signal to pull over and turn off the engine. It is simply the terrain.
Perfectly said. You use alternative capital structures like purchase money mortgages and meticulously compliant solo 401k deployments to bypass the constraints of traditional banking.
And you leverage the massive Sunbelt supply gluts to negotiate closing credits and 2-1 buy-downs that preserve your liquidity and give you a runway to actually execute your business plan.
Right, so what does this all mean?
I think it leaves us with a highly provocative question regarding the immediate future of the market.
Yeah, think about it. We know 34 out of 49 major metros remain technical buyer's markets. We know supply is piling up rapidly in Florida and Texas, while buyers are simultaneously returning to the touring process.
Right.
As traditional commercial money remains punitively expensive throughout 2026, could these specific oversupplied Sunbelt cities become the ultimate testing ground for the most aggressive and creative seller financing structures of the decade?
That is a fascinating thought.
Yeah.
Like, will the sellers who rigidly demand traditional bank financing be left stranded?
Exactly. Will only the sellers who adapt to offering deep concessions and purchase money mortgages actually cross the closer table?
It's definitely something to watch. The traffic isn't clearing up anytime soon. But the operators who know how to underwrite the chaos, who know exactly how to use their brakes, seatbelts, and shock absorbers, are the ones who are going to acquire generational assets while everyone else just waits for a green light that is never coming.
Couldn't agree more.
Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive. Take these mathematical frameworks, bring them into your next underwriting session, and keep moving forward.